Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman and I'm joined by Katie Balls and James Forsyth. Well, we've just come out of Prime Minister's questions and James, Jeremy Corbyn had a couple of different topics to talk about today.
It was a very Jeremy Corbyn PMQ's performance. He started off by praising the climate strikers, the young people who've walked out of school, and a lot of people are here today to lobby the House of Commons on climate change. And then he moved on to attacking UK arms sales to Yemen, pointing to a recent Court of Appeal judgment blocking the sale of further weapons to Yemen. I felt that exchange was a kind of classic of... No, lots of heat but no light in PMQs, because the two positions of Jeremy Corbyn's position makes it quite easy for Theresa May to attack him, because Jeremy Corbyn says, I want to stop you selling arms to Saudi Arabia, but he talks very little about the abuses being committed by the Houthi rebels in Yemen or about what is going on there. And I think the thing about the conflict in the Yemen is it is essentially in many ways a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran, with frankly bad things being done by both sides. And unless you want to recognise that fact, then I think it's very difficult. But I think it's also a reminder, though. He also moved on to the question of the whole murder of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi and MBS's alleged, I think we probably still have to say alleged, involvement in it. And I think this is a reminder that this UK relationship with Saudi Arabia, which was always politically problematic, is becoming more politically problematic. And I think one very interesting question about the next Prime Minister, particularly if it's Boris Johnson, is Boris Johnson and Theresa May, one of the big rows they had when he was Foreign Secretary was when he essentially said that in the Yemen, the Saudis were fighting a proxy war with kind of excessive brutality, essentially, and that Saudi Arabia and Iran were both responsible for stirring up trouble all over the Middle East. And I think it is an interesting question of what the UK position on that is going to become if Boris Johnson becomes Prime Minister.
Katie, do you think that the UK government has really articulated the true context that James has just explained of this war in the Yemen? Or is it something that actually Jeremy Corbyn is making some ground on politically?
Well, I think when it comes to the Labour base, whenever Jeremy Corbyn talks about Saudi Arabia, that's something that fires them up. It's clear that in many of their minds that the government's hands are muddied by this, in the sense that there is a sense of corruption. If you look at arms sales, I think it's a really easy attack line on the government. And do I think the government has responded with its own argument, which is articulate? Not so much, to be honest. I think often the government sound a little bit embarrassed about it. I think that hasn't been helped by recent events that James has mentioned.
And the Court of Appeal judgment as well, which hasn't particularly helped the government's case on this.
No. And I think there is a sense too, I mean, I think Jeremy Hunt, actually, if you look at his achievements as Foreign Secretary, he feels that he has done progress in terms of Yemen, in terms of the conflict, in terms of the fact there was at some point a ceasefire. And I think they would say that is something which is a positive on his time in that office. But I do think it is an easy thing to attack the Tories on when it comes to the relationship with Saudi Arabia. And I think the fact that there are lots of Conservatives who are themselves critical of it means it's not even particularly a unified position.
James, why does the British government need to continue this relationship with Saudi Arabia? If it, as Katie says, appears embarrassed by it, why not just publicly condemn the mistakes that the regime has made?
Well, I think that is a very good question. I mean, there are three strategic... I'm not saying they're right, but there are three strategic reasons why the UK continues this relationship. One is the view, however unsavoury and unappetising the House of Saudi is, all the alternatives in Saudi Arabia are worse. You might think that the current regime in Saudi Arabia has exported some of its Islamist problems. You might think that it funds, including in this country, mosques that spread a particular version of Islam that is not conducive to interfaith relations, to put it mildly. But the UK government's view is that all the alternatives in Saudi Arabia are worse than the current Saudi regime. Then I think the second reason is that Saudi Arabia is seen in this current regional standoff as a check to the ambitions of Iran, a regime that deeply concerns both the United States and the United Kingdom. And then I think the third thing, which I think you can't actually underestimate in this particular case, is that Saudi Arabia is a big buyer of UK defence product. And essentially, if the UK wants to maintain an arms industry, you know, Saudi Arabia is one of the people who buy lots of the stuff. And I mean, you talk to former cabinet ministers, the defence they will make is, if the Saudis aren't going to buy this stuff, the UK is going to end up, you know, losing jobs which will go elsewhere and someone else will sell them the stuff, a classic argument about arms sales. But also an argument that, you know, if you want to keep that industrial base in the UK, well, you know. I think it's worth also noticing that on the Court of Appeal judgment, Jeremy Corbyn was trying to portray it in a way that isn't entirely, I don't want to say misleading because that sounds too, but I'm not saying he's read the judgment. I mean, he was almost saying that the Court of Appeals said, don't sell arms to the Saudis because they're doing bad things with them. While actually the Court of Appeal is much more a question on the process rather than on the morality question of whether you should or shouldn't sell arms to this regime.
Now, Katie, it has been the case over the past few years that the meatier questions have actually come from the SNP benches rather than from Labour. But Ian Blackford seems to have changed his strategy since the Tory leadership contest has started, because we got round two of things he doesn't like about Boris Johnson today.
Yes, we did. And Ian Blackford suggested that Boris Johnson had made his career out of lying, which quickly caused a lot of uproar on the Conservative benches, much to the SNP's dislike. And there was a question of whether this actually is something that the Speaker should have stepped in on, because and a point of order was raised after. Now, I think he was pressed on whether he would withdraw his comment. Ian Blackford would not withdraw his comment. And just in terms of Ian Blackford's questions, he then went on to press Theresa May on whether she would announce that both Jeremy Hunt and Boris Johnson were not fit to be Prime Minister. Shockingly, Theresa May did not bite on that. And actually, she could have effectively been called him endorsing both candidates, because she said they would do a better job than anyone else. I think what the Ian Blackford exchange perhaps was most illuminating on was not so much what the SNP are trying to say about the next Tory leader or Boris Johnson. We've previously heard Ian Blackford suggest that Boris Johnson is racist. It's quite clear that how they want to attack him. But in fact, it's down to the Speaker, because I think there is a sense that if you accuse someone of lying, that's the point when the Speaker should step in. John Bercow did not do that. When later pressed on a point of order on this, he suggested that because there wasn't a specific allegation of lying, it wasn't something that he needed to intervene on. So it seems that it's fine to generally say, in John Bercow's mind, that someone is a liar. You just can't say in what way they are. Clearly, that is not going to land very well with the Conservative benches. And I think it just adds to the fact that the government and the Speaker are completely different paths. They can't agree on anything and they think that he is biased.
I think if you thought relations were bad between John Bercow and David Cameron or John Bercow and Theresa May, wait until you see relations between John Bercow and Boris Johnson, because John Bercow is just not going to be able to resist. And I think, I suspect that very early on, you'll have John Bercow basically saying, if you think you can ignore Parliament, Prime Minister, you've got another thing coming. I mean, I think you will see him pit himself against the Prime Minister from a very, very early phase in Boris Johnson's premiership.
Do you think that might lead to another push to get rid of Bercow as Speaker?
I think it is very difficult, because John Bercow plays a kind of tactical game here, right? Given the small size of the government's majority and given the number of Tory MPs who would quite like Parliament to stop no deal, I think it's A, very hard to get rid of him. And also, he will try and maintain his individual friendships on the Tory benches. There was a Jacob Rees-Mogg, who is someone who's actually kind of got on quite well with John Bercow, despite John Bercow's machinations on Brexit. You know, asked a question about a constituent if he's getting a particular drug. And John Bercow stood up and said, you know, if he wants this to be debated again before the summer recess, I am here to facilitate that. You know, it will be. So I think that that means that, you know, the Tories essentially don't have the numbers to get rid of John Bercow. They are stuck with him.
Now, just onto the Tory leadership contest, Katie. Where are we today? We've had Jeremy Hunt hosting his own leadership debate with some cold pizza at home. And he's basically decided to become the kind of almost like the Rory Stewart Mark II of this contest, just by getting attention by doing random things and calling journalists Jeremy Hunts in a reference to their inability to pronounce his surname correctly. How's it going for Hunt and for Boris Johnson?
Well, yeah, we saw Jeremy Hunt do this, and the pizza, as you mentioned, he apparently ate it cold.
Is that a Liz Truss reference?
I was about to say that it's quite Liz Truss who is backing Boris Johnson. I was quite concerned with what appeared to be pickles, kind of moved to the side of the box, because I think you'd have to add that to a pizza and then disregard it as slightly odd behaviour. I think in terms of his Twitter Q&A, now, they said lots of people have watched this. I think the question is, who is Jeremy Hunt's audience? He has today won the backing of Rory Stewart, the person he appears to be emulating in some of his tactics. I don't think that's the most shocking endorsement we've had, given that Rory Stewart spent probably half of his leadership campaign saying he couldn't support Boris Johnson, or that Boris Johnson could potentially not be trusted with the nuclear codes. But when it comes to Jeremy Hunt's tactics, he clearly is trying the approach of just doing lots of media because he is not the front runner and trying to get his message out. Now, I think that he has surprised some by having some good Twitter witty comments. But
do we think that he's writing them or someone else is doing that for him?
I've been told by people on the Hunt campaign that Jeremy Hunt has got into Twitter in this campaign and in a way that he hadn't previously. And a lot of this is personally coming from him. I will lead listeners to decide. But I think there are two potential problems here. First off, I suspect that the people following the Twitter Q&A are not the Tory grassroots members he needs to win round. Secondly, it is getting pretty blue on blue right now between the Jeremy Hunt and the Boris Johnson camps. And that is on both sides. I think it is fair to say that Jeremy Hunt has been at the most probably on the offensive and starting it. But yesterday, suggesting Boris Johnson is a coward for not doing the debate, bringing in this question of character, even though constantly insisting that personal life had nothing to do with it. And we saw yesterday the Boris Johnson campaign begin to hit back, with Boris Johnson talking about his Brexit deadline. And this was after a mini media blitz, I think you could say. But in the talk radio interview, he said that it was do or die on getting the UK out by the end of October. You have then had Boris Johnson take to social media with his letter asking Jeremy Hunt to confirm when he plans to take the UK out. Now, we already know Jeremy Hunt's position on this is that ultimately, he would extend on the grounds that he could still see it would lead to a deal. He says he would only go for a no deal if he really believed there was no chance. So I think that does mean it's extending. But I think in response to that, again, you see Jeremy Hunt suggesting, well, this plan would mean no Brexit. And I do wonder if Boris Johnson, as we expect, manages to win this contest, and Jeremy Hunt, as we expect, wants to keep not only a cabinet job, but a great office of state. In every television interview or radio interview Jeremy Hunt does in the next couple of months, where they ask him about Boris Johnson's Brexit position, which is to leave by the end of October, they will just simply say, well, you said this will deliver no Brexit. So I can see how in the short-term effects of the contest, and clearly you need to fight the contest because there's a chance, but I think the tactics do make it hard to see how it is sustainable to have someone like that then to have a senior role in a government, which you've criticised the position of.
James, on that point by Katie, do you think that collective responsibility is going to be particularly strong underneath a Boris Johnson premiership? It obviously hasn't really existed over the past few months for Theresa May, but it was a feature of the start of this contest where candidates were saying that they would be very disciplined about cabinet collective responsibility. Is that going to be something that Boris Johnson could actually achieve?
So as I understand it, the Boris Johnson position is they want to, I mean, everyone wants to restore collective responsibility, but the idea is going to be this: to serve in that cabinet, you are going to have to sign up to the idea that the UK is leaving the EU on October 31st. But now, unlike some people, he's not going to try and open windows into men's souls and say to people, are you embracing no deal? Because the government's policy and preference will still be to try and get a deal. But you will have to accept that point, that if there is not a new deal by October 31st, the UK is leaving the EU regardless. As it was put to me by one of those closest to him, what they want to end is a situation where cabinet meetings are debating pre-existing policy. Now, I think his ability to impose that discipline will depend in large part on what happens in the result of this members' round. I think, as Katie says in our icon today, I think the analysis is right on this, which is if Boris Johnson wins a thumping victory, he has much more moral authority over his cabinet to say, look, we fought a leadership contest in the members' round. One of the main dividing lines between Jeremy Hunt and I was this October the 31st question, and say, you know, two-thirds of the party or backed me. So look, that is the position, and we're going to stick to it. That's very different to a situation where Boris Johnson has flopped over the line and we're all saying, oh, maybe if his contest had gone on for another 2 weeks, maybe the result would have been different. Then he would have less authority. The other thing I think is hugely important to Boris Johnson, now this is ironic given the troubles that industry has had in recent years, but I think what the polls say about Boris Johnson when he first gets into Downing Street are going to matter a huge amount as well. Because if the Tories get a poll boost, and don't laugh when I say this, and they break back into the 30s, then you'll have kind of renewed authority within the government. And I mean, the cabinet will be more inclined to accept his point of view if this October 31st thing is clearly working to the extent of bringing back voters from the Brexit Party. I think even those who in private have doubts about it will be more prepared to say, okay, right, I can see the logic of this. I can see how it is working.
Thank you, James, and thank you, Katie, and thanks for listening to this. Do please send us your feedback. We love your entertaining messages about this podcast and suggestions for how we can improve, particularly when you tell us that we shouldn't be on the podcast ourselves. Do send your feedback to podcast@spectator.co.uk. Thanks for listening.